It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the annual State of the Tribes address was delivered today at the state capitol. We find out what the most pressing issues were.
First, the Wisconsin Assembly ends its session this week. Lawmakers are considering a number of bills that will need to be approved or put on hold by Friday. Joining us to talk about what's being considered in the Assembly and the Senate is Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Veronica.
So give me a sense, what is the volume of bills that we're talking about here?
I was thinking, I mean, every time we talk, it feels like we say we've got a busy day ahead of us in the legislature. Mm-hmm. So we really mean it this time. I mean, we're talking like more than 100 bills in the state assembly are on the calendar for today, roughly 50 bills in the state Senate. And, you know, to put that in more context, they're a few hours late getting started today. So that means it's probably going to go pretty late into the night.
And is this unusual, this volume that we're looking at, or is this sort of the normal as we go along so far?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the actual numbers. Every end of session has a last-minute push for a bunch of bills, and it gets a little crazy at the end. That is definitely not new. This just feels like an awful lot this year.
Now, you said things are running a few hours late. Was anything passed this morning?
Only the stuff that they could all agree on in the Senate, which meant not too much. They passed a bill that would regulate kickboxing in Wisconsin, and that was about it. They've got a lot coming up in the Senate where they're not going to agree so well, including there's a bill in there that would allow for the sale of water utilities to private companies, make that a lot easier than it is right now. A lot of stuff in there having to do with lakes and wetlands, too.
And one of the more controversial bills that's being considered, one that's been debated in Wisconsin over the past weeks and months or so, is a moratorium on new nuclear power plants and whether that could be lifted. Where is that one?
That one is up in the Senate today. It's probably going to pass. This is something that has been talked about session after session. Seems like there's been a push to lift that decades-old moratorium on new nuclear power plants. It's always come up short. It's not exactly a moratorium. It just says that to build a new nuclear power plant in Wisconsin, there first has to be a federal site to deposit the waste. We don't have that yet. And that it also has to be the right choice or the advantageous choice for as far as the market goes, as far as energy consumers. So, you know, you could meet both of those guidelines and build a nuclear power plant right now, but what they're going to do is lift those requirements. Does that mean there's going to be a new nuclear power plant in Wisconsin? It does not. Nobody's saying that, but this would make it an option.
Now, that has been one of the more controversial bills, but that's not the only one by any means. What are some of the other more hotly contested bills that the Assembly is going to look at today?
I think, you know, I mentioned that one in the Senate on the sale of water utilities. That is something that didn't get a lot of attention earlier in the session. It actually passed the Assembly on a voice vote, but it's kind of caught on as an issue since everything that's happened in Flint with the trouble with the water there. It's not like this bill would, snap your fingers, pass it, and we've got Flint here in Wisconsin, but environmental groups say that this is one step in that direction, that if you take water utilities, they argue, out of the public's hands, put them in the hands of a private company, which would be easier under this bill, that there will be more of a concern about cutting costs than there will be about water safety. So that's up in the Senate today. I think you go on and, you know, look at there's a bill that would allow for, I guess would prohibit local ordinances in the assembly that where people ask someone about their immigration status. So those ordinances would be banned. It would also ban local photo identification cards in lieu of a driver's license. So those are both areas where the assembly is getting into the immigration debate. There's also a bill up in the Senate that would change rules for legislators and county executives. It would say that if you're a legislator, you can't subsequently you can't concurrently be a county executive. And Democrats say that's pretty clearly aimed at Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris, who is running for the legislature as a Democrat in really the most competitive Senate race this year.
We're talking to Sean Johnson right now, Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about what's happening in the Senate and the Assembly today. We've said it is a very busy day. That's a bit of an understatement. And so, Sean, let's look at another couple of bills. There are some affecting public schools in the works. What's going on there?
Yeah, the big one is it's going to change the way that public schools are able to increase property taxes to make up for students that they lose to private voucher schools. So in the latest expansion of the private school voucher program in Wisconsin, they changed the way that the voucher program is funded. And so now, as students move from public schools to private schools, public schools are losing more funding because of it. They have right now a mechanism where they can make up for some of that by increasing property taxes. This would take that away, and so public schools view that as a cut of $14 million. Republicans say that, you know, you shouldn't be getting that property tax money anyway if you're not getting the students.
And Governor Walker has been issuing ideas for college tuition, making college hopefully more affordable. What legislation are we seeing there?
You're seeing pretty much all of the governor's higher education package that he talked about in his State of the State address this year. It was basically the only thing he asked for in his State of the State. So a couple of the big ones in there, he would create a new tax deduction for college loans. He would also increase a state higher ed grant for technical colleges. Those are bills that higher ed administrators like. So the UW system, the technical college system, theirs in support of those bills. Democrats say they really don't go far enough, that they don't let somebody refinance their student debt, which is really kind of the cornerstone of what Democrats have been pushing for. And then you've got Republicans in the Senate who say they actually go a little too far because they cost the state money that some Senate Republicans feel like the state shouldn't be spending right now because the state faces potential budget issues. And a number of Republicans have said, we don't want to spend anything more than maybe $20 million before we get out of here this year. So they may actually scale those back once they get to the Senate.
And Sean, the State of the Tribes was today, and one bill that we've been tracking over the weeks on Central Time was a proposed bill to allow the excavation of Native American burial mounds. Where did that one end up?
That one basically hit a wall. I mean, the Assembly Speaker said a few weeks back that that was not something that he was going to support. It's not on the calendar now. It is something that they've talked about forming a study committee to look into, but that's not going to be coming up in this, you know, chaotic end of session rush here. At least it's not on the list of 100 bills up for today.
Well, one that is on the list for today, a little bit controversial here, one that would allow people to register to vote online. And it's not that part that's been controversial. It's been some of the things that go along with it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the part of the bill that has everybody on board, the part that takes away is where the bill loses a number of Democrats who actually had been co-sponsoring the electronic voter registration plan. So what it would do is it would allow you, as the name implies, would allow you to register to vote online if you have a driver's license or state ID. The catch is it would eliminate special registration deputies. So that's why you hear groups like the League of Women Voters, who use special registration deputies to go out on voter registration drives, strongly opposed to this plan. They say it's like bait and switch, essentially. Backers say those special registration deputies won't be as important when anybody can go out and register people to vote with a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop.
And Sean, before we let you go, any laws that do have bipartisan support in the legislature?
One that's interesting, we'll see to see how they approach it, is this bill that would crack down on repeat drunk drivers. That's also scheduled for a vote today in the State Assembly. It passed on a voice vote in the Senate. The catch with that bill is it's really expensive. According to the Department of Corrections, it could cost the state up to $130 million a year. So that may very well have bipartisan support in the legislature. But given how little the state has in reserves right now, that $130 million a year price tag, could come back to bite them.
Sean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. He joined us there to talk about what's happening in the Senate and the Assembly today in a marathon session.
Coming up, we talk about what issues were covered in the annual State of the Tribes address given today at the Wisconsin State Capitol.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what role does feminism play in the presidential race this year? We'll talk about feminism and politics.
First, earlier today, Lacoudere Chairman Mick Isham gave this year's State of the Tribes address at the Wisconsin State Capitol. It was streamed live on WPR.org, and you can listen to the archived audio there as well. In this, the 12th of these annual addresses, Isham brought up several issues of importance to Wisconsin's Native population, including a recent proposal to allow for the excavation of Native burial mounds and what he sees as the erosion of the state's natural resources.
Joining us now to give impressions of the address, we have Janice Rice and Patty Lowe. Janice, member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, outreach coordinator for the College Library at UW-Madison until her recent retirement, past president of the American Indian Library Association, and she served as archivist for the Ho-Chunk people. Also with us, Patty Lowe, professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication, where she teaches digital storytelling. She's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and an affiliated faculty with the American Indian Studies Program. She's written books on the Native American experience and history in Wisconsin. So thanks to both of you for joining us. And Patty, let's start with you. Can you describe, as laid out in the speech, how we heard about the relationship between the tribes of Wisconsin and the state government?
Yeah, as the speech unfolded, I was reminded of the Dale Carnegie book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It had that flow of, okay, here, let's be positive in the beginning and talk about all the places where we, you know, have this sort of kumbaya relationship. And then it worked up to the environmental issues where the tribes and the state obviously disagree. And then he brought it back to, you know, we have this relationship, we have these processes and these organizations and committees that we can work through for the mutual benefit of both Native and non-Native people in Wisconsin.
And Patty, a theme through this was kind of myths and misconceptions versus reality of Wisconsin tribes. And one key theme he kept coming back to is this is not a historical holdover. This is not a part of Wisconsin's past. This is today.
Right. And I think he made the point quite clearly that the tribes are economic generators in this state. The 11 federally recognized tribes generate more than $1 billion in revenue to the state. And by local, he made the point that unlike some of the big box stores, the tribes in their counties buy from local vendors. And that drew one of the many standing ovations that he got during his speech.
And Janice, let's bring you in on this now. Patty was telling us in this speech we heard about the positives of how the state can work together with the tribes, but also some of the challenges. Looking long term, do you see improvements? Do you see the tribes and the state more able to cooperate than maybe they were, I don't know, 12 years ago when we first started having these annual addresses?
I see progress because I can see the difference already in some of the partnerships that have happened, and then even more people being to articulate what those partnerships have been and continue to be. And some of the things I see, just not being a person from northern Wisconsin, I see it more readily when I step in and I see what's there, some of the improvements and some of the things that they talked about in the high school that are happening in Lacoudere with the superintendent who's making such a difference with being able to cooperate with the school and let the football teams team up, players from the LCO school be with the high school team and play football together. And just some things that you never would have seen, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, many years ago, you would not have seen that. So that's just one example of what I'm seeing of the partnerships that are working. And I think they're seeing each other as citizens and real people, and that they're teaming up together. So I hope I can see more of that along the way.
Well, that reminds me, in the State of the Tribes address, we heard in some ways that, hey, the problems we're all talking about in Wisconsin, they're problems for tribes, they're problems for everybody else. And one thing he was referring to was prescription drug addiction, and talking about how, yeah, that's That's an everybody problem here. And that was a place he saw future partnership, changing some rules, some red tape in some ways, that the same things we can do at the state level could be done at the tribal level.
I agree. I see that he's involving many, he as well as other tribal leaders are involving the leadership that they have within their own clinics and the different social services agencies, because they are filling those positions with own tribal members who understand the culture and the language of the people. Plus, they can speak the language of the partners in the county and in the state. So they're all speaking the same language, and I think that's starting to make a difference because they're understanding one another better than they had before. So I'm starting to see that partnership evolve because the social services agencies have to deal with it as well as the healthcare institutions on the reservations and in the counties as well and out there in the communities.
We're talking about today's State of the Tribes address delivered at the Capitol by Lakota Ray Chairman Mick Isham. We have Patty Lowe and Janice Rice with us to talk about it. Now, we've been talking about cooperation here. One issue that flared up and went away, at least for the time being, was this proposal to make it easier for property owners, Patty, to develop on mounds, burial mounds.
Right.
And that got nipped in the bud. Mick Isham saying, for now, and this is something we need to be vigilant about. So what kind of message was he sending there?
Well, I think they were saying that on environmental issues, and Janice, maybe I think you probably would agree with me, even though it was perceived to be a Ho-Chunk issue, he was sending the message that, when it comes to environmental protection, whether it's cultural protection of burial mounds of a particular tribe, or whether it's clean air, clean water, or chronic wasting disease, he talked about that a bit. But the message was, we are all standing together on this. And I think that was loud and clear. And I think that one of the things that he articulated quite well is the role of tribes as environmental stewards. We're the ones whose communities eat the food that is coming out of our lakes and rivers. We're the ones that are consuming the wild rice. We eat more venison than anyone else. We're picking more berries. And so we're the ones that, you know, whose livelihoods, whose health and livelihoods are really on the line. So trust us when we tell you we're seeing changes, or trust us when we're telling you that we know ways that we can do things better and protect these resources for everyone.
And that was another case where it sounded like he was saying, hey, this is something that this has been a point of conflict in the past, especially when you think of fishing, spear fishing, fishing for subsistence versus sport fishing. He's saying, however you fish and however you hunt, we're all using the same land here. We all have the same interest in it. So, again, do you see room, Janice, for the kind of environmental partnership and that stewardship that Patty was talking about?
I see a future where we can cooperate, and it seems like they already have, especially with Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission, some of the things that have already opened up way back when and then have continued to evolve. And then we're getting more young people that are getting degrees in these areas, younger people from our reservation. So I think those partnerships are going to continue to grow, and we're going to have more people with expertise in those areas, the young ones today. And so I'm really pleased to see more of the young people coming to these things and paying attention to what their tribal leaders are saying. So I have hope.
And rather than spending all of our time and resources in court fighting about who gets the last fish, let's improve the resource and make sure there's enough fish for everyone.
And another point that I hadn't necessarily expected to see, a redistricting of legislative districts in Wisconsin. I've heard people in small towns complain like, hey, you just redistricted us in half. Well, he's saying, I think he was talking about the Lakota Ray there. They got redistricted. This is something that people might not think of as a Native American issue in particular, Patty.
But it is. It's an issue for everyone in the state, but it's an issue when, especially when that particular reservation leans toward one party or the other, when an area gets redistricted, it makes a difference politically. And he also made the point that Native Americans are voting in numbers like they've never voted before. We're seeing tribal members run for county board positions and city council positions. And what that means, if it follows the way the political process usually works, is those people then run for a state office or a federal office. That's where the political engagement begins, at those local local levels.
And that was a really interesting point, too. He had said, hey, we're not non-voters and we're not Democratic voters. He listed right. Democrats and Republicans. He said, we're constituents. You come, you talk to us, you do what we want, and then maybe you get our vote. Do you think that legislators have been thinking that way and responding that way, Janice?
I don't think they necessarily have, but for the few events that I've gone to, the legislators have said the other thing to me, you don't come to my stuff. This is the first time I'm hearing them say, well, they got to come to us too. So I guess it is a two-way street. So I think if some of those doors are opened a little more widely, I think that would make a difference.
Well, I was just going to say, at the root of all of this is this notion of Act 31 being an important springboard to teach everyone in the state about Wisconsin Indian history, treaty rights, sovereignty. So regardless of where or what issue we wind up talking about, whether it's health and welfare, whether it's environmental issues, we have some basis of understanding. And that mandate may not be exercised evenly throughout the state, but it has created a basis of understanding.
Well, I hope we can talk to you about more of these issues in the future. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
That's Janice Rice and Patty Lowe. We've been talking about today's State of the Tribes address. You can hear the whole thing at WPR.org.
Coming up, we'll look at how feminism fits into this year's presidential race. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As presidential hopefuls continue to battle one another for their party's nominations, the candidates are courting the votes of one of the nation's largest demographics, women.
Since women's suffrage nearly a century ago, we've seen issues like workplace equality and reproductive rights take the spotlight. This is due in part to the feminist movement and its activists who advocated that women are entitled to the same basic freedoms that men have.
But the term feminist has been a double-edged sword in recent American politics. Some embrace the label, others distance themselves from it.
In this year's presidential race, candidates like Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are picking up the banner of feminist, and some, like former GOP candidate Carly Fiorina, included conversations about feminism in her campaign without explicitly calling herself a feminist. Joining us now to talk about feminism and the 2016 presidential race is Claire Foran, associate editor of The Atlantic. Claire, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what kinds of arguments are unfolding today about what the word feminist means in the 2016 election?
Well, I think that there's been arguments that have kind of split along a political divide. So as you mentioned, Carly Fiorina, who just dropped out of the race, she had sort of advanced her own definition of feminism, and that sort of sparked debate over, can you be a conservative feminist? What's the difference between kind of a liberal or progressive and a conservative version of feminism? So you have that political split. And then you also have, on the Democratic side, sort of this generational divide where you have younger and older women kind of debating what it means to be feminist.
Does saying that you're a feminist today have more political weight, maybe even some baggage, at least this election cycle compared to other cycles?
Well, I think that you certainly are seeing in this election cycle the controversy that can come along with attempts to sort of stake a claim to a definition of what feminism means. And you've particularly seen that in light of Hillary Clinton's campaign, comments made by Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem talking sort of about they've made comments that have been interpreted by some to sort of imply, women should vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman and if they consider themselves feminists. And that's sparked a lot of backlash.
And we have some clips of that, some of those statements you're talking about, including, as you said, longtime feminist activist Gloria Steinem, who had this to say on Real Time with Bill Maher.
And when you're young, you're thinking, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie or,
Ooh. Now, if I said that...
No.
Interesting comment there. It does sort of set up this divide between sort of older school feminists and how young women might consider themselves feminists today, what it means to them. How would you say that the comments like that are being dissected and understood by women who are voting in this election?
Well, I think it's been interesting to see the reaction to Gloria Steinem's comment. It's, you know, various people have tried to parse what exactly she meant, and she herself later sort of said she misspoke. But the backlash has been interesting. A lot of younger women felt that it was sort of an insulting comment, that it was essentially implying, you know, that they were chasing after boys, and that was the only reason why maybe they'd support Sanders. But I think it does speak to this generational divide that we're seeing in the poll numbers. Hillary Clinton is doing better with older women and younger women. She's losing those voters to Bernie Sanders in a lot of polling data. So I think it sort of reflects this split, and that's been interesting to see.
Does that mean, do you think, that older women are more likely to feel some sort of loyalty to maybe the feminist movement as they understood it from earlier days and as they understand it now, or that younger women are just maybe considering a gender as one part of a bigger package of who a candidate is?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's impossible to say that there's one reason for it, because you know, women are obviously a diverse voting bloc, and different women might have different reasons, you know, for picking the candidate. Well, certainly do have different reasons for picking the candidate they want to support. But I think that the point you made of younger women seeing gender as sort of one category and kind of a broad array of things that they're going to consider is an interesting point, and there has been speculation that younger generations view feminism in this more intersectional lens, where they consider how things like what a candidate is like on issues of class and race, and how those can kind of intersect with things like women's issues, and so maybe a candidate's gender is not going to be the most important criteria for younger feminists.
We're talking with Claire Foran right now, associate editor at The Atlantic, and she's joining us to talk about the role feminism is having in the 2016 election. A comment here from Bernard, this came in via email, who said, gender is immaterial to Hillary's record. Women in general would benefit far more from a Sanders presidency. And that's something that both male supporters of Sanders and women supporters are saying, that, you know, I can be a feminist and vote for a man because the policies they think are there to benefit women in a Sanders candidacy.
Yeah, and I think that some, you know, some younger feminists would even say it's sexist to tell me that I should be voting as a feminist for a candidate simply because she's women, because that would be kind of a reductive way of looking at it. And I certainly think there are a lot of younger feminists who would say that Bernie Sanders, they believe, would be a better feminist candidate.
And we have a clip of Carly Fiorina as well, a former GOP candidate. She's now dropped out of the race. And here she is speaking with the Wall Street Journal last year.
To me, a feminist is any woman who chooses her own life. Whether she chooses to run for president or chooses to have five children and homeschool them, a woman has to have the opportunity to use her God-given gifts. Women are half the potential of this nation.
So Carly Fiorina getting in on what her definition is, I guess, is that a problem for women, that there is sort of an open debate about what being a feminist means if you're a woman hoping to get other women to vote for you and no one can really agree on what the point of feminism is? Then you don't really have a unified voting bloc.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's never been, you know, one singular definition of feminism. So debate that's cropping up in this election cycle, you know, it may be a debate of a bit of a different nature. It may be debate that's sort of particularly suited to this time and era, but it's not new or anything unusual to sort of have contested definitions of what it means to be feminist. So in that sense, you know, it shouldn't be that surprising that we're having these types of conversations.
But it seems like if you look at, say, the feminist movement in the 60s, it might have seemed more likely then for the crowning achievement of the feminist movement to have a woman in the White House, and it doesn't seem like feminists agree on that.
Yeah, I do think that that's something that, you know, when you look at the way that Madeleine Albright has talked about sort of her comments have been, you know, she has this famous line of there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And it's a very gender based idea, this idea that, you know, you elevate women and then that's a win for the feminist movement. And I don't know that younger feminists necessarily agree with that.
So with Carly Fiorina dropping out of the race, I mean, she was approaching feminism from a conservative perspective, Hillary and maybe some of her supporters from a more liberal perspective. But it seemed as though because those issues were both being talked about, you didn't get this narrative that, okay, feminism is mainly the domain of lefties or liberals. It was sort of, okay, this is something that everybody can talk about from both sides. Now that she's gone, what happens to that political analysis of feminism?
Yeah, I think that was an interesting aspect of Carly Fiorina's candidacy. Is she was essentially, in some ways, she was agreeing with some of the basic premises that liberal or progressive feminists often put forward. She talked about the idea that the playing field isn't equal for women. She called attention to issues such as, you know, underrepresentation of women on atop the corporate ladder, the prevalence of sexism in the workplace. So she was essentially kind of validating these central ideas that a lot of progressives would say are true and are problems that we should be thinking about. And I think that created a situation where then you could have a debate about, well, what do we do about it? And Carly Fiorina, as this conservative candidate, she would have had a very different answer to that question of what are the solutions than somebody like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. But having her in the race agreeing on those initial premises at least opened the door for that debate. And I think now that debate on the Republican side may be non-existent. And it's sort of going to be an issue potentially that Republicans are sort of ceding almost to the liberals in the race.
We're talking to Claire Foran right now, associate editor at The Atlantic, to talk about the role that feminism is having in the 2016 election. And we want to know what you think. Do you see feminism taking a prominent role in this election? Do you see a generational divide maybe between older and younger feminists? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your comments and your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about what it means to be a feminist, what feminism means in the 2016 presidential race. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about feminism and politics? How do you see it all playing out in the 2016 candidates? What do you think of the party's visions of the role of women in society, legal protections for them? Any individual candidates that you're liking or not when you think about them in this way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post online at the Central Time Facebook page.
Claire Foran stays with us. She is an associate editor at The Atlantic. And so, Claire, looking at where we are now, Carly Fiorina out of the race, Hillary Clinton had a couple of heavy hitters from the feminist movement, Gloria Steinem, Madeleine Albright, trying to go to bat for her, and that backfired. Where does Hillary Clinton go now with this?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that it's clear that, as you said, you know, there was certainly backlash to this sort of latest wave of feminist icons kind of speaking out in support of her candidacy or talking about, you know, sort of the dynamics of feminism in the race. And so I think that, you know, that's really highlighted this generational divide. And it seems like right now the sort of demographic group that Hillary Clinton is kind of struggling to appeal to within this conversation is sort of the younger women. So, you know, I would imagine that her campaign is probably acutely aware of that data and is probably thinking about ways that it can kind of appeal to this younger generation.
So speaking of data, there was some about, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 years ago that younger women, probably more in the millennial generation, weren't as keen to be identified as feminists. Do you think that that is still true? And if so, is that having any bearing here?
Yeah, I think that that's an interesting question to look at. I mean, there's been some data to suggest that, you know, sometimes people, women or people in general are hesitant to call themselves feminists, even if they believe in many of sort of the underlying qualities that, that people would often associate with feminism, such as sort of equality for men and women. So I think that they're, you know, there's sort of the whole question of who actually adopts this label. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see how that might be playing out in the race. It's possible that that younger women may not even, the idea of sort of the feminist label might not even be resonant with some younger voters. And perhaps that might be another kind of generational split as well.
Now, the Sanders campaign has gotten some criticism for some Bernie supporters, Bernie Sanders, who've been saying, and they've been called the Bernie Bros. These are men who have been critical of Clinton supporters, especially women who support her, and this has been happening online. Can you talk about what that might be doing to the political conversation here?
Yeah, I mean, the it's funny, the Bernie Bros, there's been... you know, not everybody agrees kind of who should be kind of called a Bernie bro. I mean, that term is often sort of thrown around in the case where sort of Bernie Sanders supporters in online kind of forums are using maybe like sexist kind of language. And, you know, I think that that's been kind of a flashpoint for this debate, to the extent that I think some people wonder, you know, how much support for Sanders versus Clinton cleaves along these gendered lines. And there's sort of that question of, you know, does he get away with things that Clinton doesn't get away with because she's a woman candidate? You know, one thing that a lot of people cite in their reasons why they like Sanders is because he's so, you know, he can be very unkempt. He speaks off the cuff. Sometimes he sounds very angry. And those tend to be qualities that people who like Sanders say they really like about him. They say that that's a sign of authenticity. And I do think there's a real question of, you know, if you applied those same traits, if Clinton, you know, yelled more, if she had sort of an unkempt appearance, I think there's a real question of, you know, would she get that same reaction, or is there a double standard at play? And I think with the Bernie Bros, people have been sort of critical of that maybe subset of supporters have raised those questions and said, you know, is there sort of sexism kind of at play in the support for Sanders versus Clinton?
We're going to take a caller right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'll go first to Barbara in Marshfield. Barbara, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to respond a little bit because I feel like that we're really using an antiquated term here. Feminism, that's an old term. And it's got kind of a negative tone, too. I agree with some of what they said before. It kind of labels us if we talk about our rights as women or backing each other. And right now, it's almost as if we're trying to put a negative swing on the Clinton campaign by just talking about it. And it's almost as if the media keeps digging up this feminism as a negativity.
All right, Barbara, I want to get Claire's response to that. We've only got a little bit of time left here. So, Claire, what do you say to that? Barbara, thinking there that using the word the mantle of feminism is not going to help Hillary Clinton's campaign, and that it sounds like the media and maybe Hillary should not be using that if she wants to move forward here.
Well, I do think, yeah, I mean, some people really have a negative reaction to the label of feminism, and I think that there's different reasons why people reject the term, and there could be sort of a wide array of reasons why people may not like the term. But I think one reason is that sometimes people think that, you know, just to label anybody in any way can be divisive. And I do think that perhaps... you know, it's something that Clinton... So I think the Clinton campaign has this sort of challenge, which is that on the one hand, in this election in particular, the campaign has really been emphasizing this historic nature of her candidacy as potentially the first woman president. And that wasn't something that they emphasized as much last time Clinton was running for president. And I think that the campaign sees that as a potential strength. But on the flip side, you know, the more you talk about things like that, the more that you know, that's not quite the same as using the feminist label, but I think it does, you know, highlighting kind of gender, potentially for the, some of the same reasons that people might not like that label of feminism. Some people might find that to be kind of divisive. They might find it to be kind of insulting that you would kind of reduce a candidacy to something like that. So I think these are all kind of things that the campaign, you know, is inevitably thinking about and trying to kind of thread the needle on.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Barbara. And we're going to go next to Mark in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
I'd like to ask the question, what does the definition or self-claim of being a feminist mean by comparison of, say, Jill Stein to Hillary Clinton, when Jill Stein is against all the wars that we're engaged in, and Hillary Clinton was the head of, was the Secretary of State engaging in a lot of those wars? How does one claim to be a feminist? And what does the stance on war mean as regards one's definition of a feminist?
All right, Mark, thanks for that. Clear thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question because it sort of gets into, you know, if you're going to define yourself as a feminist, to what extent does that become a lens through which you tackle maybe other things that might not immediately seem like a women's issue? So something like conflict, and I think for somebody like for any candidate that uses the term feminism, I don't know that that's immediately apparent. Most of the candidates who've talked about feminism have, you know, given sort of their interpretation of it. Hillary Clinton has, her most basic definition has been to say, she's been to say, I believe in equal rights. A feminist is by definition someone who believes in equal rights. And so that's kind of, that, you know, I guess helps us understand how she thinks about it, but it doesn't necessarily answer, you know, these other questions such as how does that then apply to these other issues that maybe don't fall within that sphere of sort of gender equality or women's rights.
Well, Mark, thank you for that call. And Claire, thank you to you. We leave it there.
Thank you.
That was Claire Foran, an associate editor at The Atlantic. She wrote an article called A Defeat for Feminism, detailing Carly Fiorina's exit from the presidential race. And you can find that on the Central Time Facebook page. Check it out and leave us a comment while you're there.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. We'll look at the impact of recent debates and the new battle over the Supreme Court on the presidential race.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has changed its online comment policy, restricting it to paid subscribers. The editor will join us to tell us how he's hoping to cut back on incivility on his website.
And we'll continue our series on literacy here in Wisconsin with a look at efforts to improve our technological literacy.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.